Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is George Werthner. He's the Ecological Projects Director for the Foundation for Deep Ecology. He's an ecologist and wildlands activist. He's published 38 books on environmental issues and natural history, including such environmentally focused books as well for ranching, wildfire, thrillcraft, energy, and fairly recently, Keeping the Wild. But you have another book out since then. What's that?
Protecting the Wild.
Protecting the Wild. And today,
which is a follow-up to the first.
Okay, great. Today we talk about fire. So thank you for your work and thank you for being on the program.
Well, thank you for having me.
So tell me about fire.
All right. I'll start sort of at the beginning, which is that wildfire is a natural ecological process of rejuvenation and of ecosystems throughout most of the western United States. And as a result, we need to have wildfire in our forests. The idea that a healthy forest is one that doesn't burn is actually inaccurate. A healthy forest has periodic fire in it. And often these fires are severe enough to kill a lot of the larger trees. And that would be completely normal in most ecosystems as well. But we have gotten onto a program of fire suppression and the view that fires are somehow a bad thing to have allowed to run without control. And that is a natural consequence of sort of putting house fires out in our minds as destructive and transferring that to the forest and figuring, well, if a house burns up, if the forest burns up, it must be equally as bad. But in fact, it's not. It is somewhat analogous to how floods, periodic floods, will bring new soil and nutrients to riverside floodplains. Fires are something that helps to recycle nutrients, changes the conditions for different plants and animals, favoring some that need fire and require fire. And it is also one of the major ways that we get dead wood into our ecosystems, which is a very important structural component for forest ecosystems and even rivers, too. The dead logs fall into rivers. They're important structural components of rivers. So all around, wildfires can generally be considered a beneficial thing, and yet we have this negative viewpoint of it. In fact, it's very difficult to talk about wildfires in the media without using pejorative terms. If you look at headlines, it'll say a ferocious wildfire destroyed so many acres, or a catastrophic wildfire burned up the forest. And these are generally perceived as being negative, and yet, from an ecological perspective, it's perhaps the best thing that could happen to a lot of these ecosystems.
So give me a headline that you would write about a large wildfire.
I would say something like a large wildfire created 100,000 acres of new wildlife habitat and rejuvenated the forest ecosystem. It's kind of long, but you get the idea.
Yeah. Let's presume that people listening to this care about forests, and they are biocentric, and they love the real world. And let's presume also that they don't know much about forests except the propaganda they've gotten from the Forest Service or the mainstream press. And you talked a little bit about, you know, rejuvenating, you are releasing nutrients. You mentioned dead wood, but can you get really specific and really make it clear how a forest helps a fire-dependent forest? What are some of the things? Like, for example, I've read somewhere that that dead standing trees oftentimes make more habitat for birds, insects, small mammals than live standing trees do. So can you just talk about some things like that?
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. For example, 45% of all bird species depend on dead trees at some point in their life cycle. Now, they may be like cavity nesters, woodpeckers that nest in them. They may be birds like the black-back woodpecker that feeds on insects in the dead trees. It could be a bald eagle.
Let's be explicit about the black-backed woodpecker. Why are their backs black?
Because they are found primarily in recently burned forests. And in fact, after about 8 to 10 years, you will not find them in that forest anymore because they move on to the next place that's been burned, and it's critical to them to have burned forests. But there's a lot of, like 10% of all, I mean, a lot of people may not think this is important, but 10% of all lichen species are found on dead wood. Many mushroom fungi species are found only on burnt wood and burnt forests and after fires. There are many small mammals that depend on the dead trees for, you know, they live in cavities like the birds do, or when the trees fall to the ground, they live under the dead trees and find their home and safety there. So even the trees that fall into streams are important. They're a source of nutrients to stream aquatic insects, and they provide resting places for fish like trout that rest behind the logs that are falling in the stream. And those fallen logs keep the stream banks, they armor the stream banks and keep them from eroding as rapidly. So there are all sorts of ways that burnt forests help the ecosystem. And one more that's even important today, and it may surprise people, is that burnt forests actually store a lot of carbon as well, more so than if the trees are cut and used for housing or whatever. Charcoal is very resistant to erosion and decomposition, and so it's a good way to store carbon for long periods of time. And when you have a fire, if you think about it, if you've ever been to one, what burns in a fire is the small needles and branches. That's why you have snags left over after a fire and so much wood. So most of that wood and that biomass remains on the site unless, of course, an agency like the Forest Service comes in and does post-fire logging, which has no ecological benefits whatsoever.
There's a line that a fisheries biologist one time said to me that I'm thinking of it here too, that she said every time a river floods, and you mentioned floods earlier, every time a river floods, it makes her really sad because of all the, you know, fish and frogs and trees who die in this, but at the same time, it makes her really happy because that's how, like you said, new habitat is created. And what she said is, every time she sees a flood, she thinks, okay, this is short-term habitat loss with the destruction, and it's long-term habitat gain. And it sounds like that's what you're saying here, too.
Yeah, in a way, this is a hard thing for people to get their minds around. But periodic large wildfires are the major source of dead wood input into forest ecosystems. In other words, there's always a background mortality of trees, but what sustains the forest over the long haul is these episodic large inputs of dead trees, which will last in the ecosystem sometimes for hundreds of years before they're completely, you know, decomposed and recycled back into, you know, growing material to other trees. And so if you short circuit these fires so that they were not killing trees, you would be short circuiting that ecosystem's reliance on periodic input of dead trees.
Okay, I want to talk about two different types of fire. First, I want to talk about let's talk about three attitudes of people. One attitude would be, put every fire out, fires are bad. Let's just dismiss that for a moment. We can come back to it later. The next one is that historically, a lot of the people who believe that, who understand that forests need fires, they believed, and I've actually written about this, that fires were historically low there would be a lot of, like the Blue Mountains are called that because there was so much smoke in the summer from all sorts of low intensity fires. And then there's also what you're talking about now is also high intensity fires. Can we talk for a moment about low intensity fires and what they do? And just like for 2 minutes or something, tell me about low intensity fires. And then let's move from there to the high intensity fires that you're talking about now. So first, just a couple of minutes on a low intensity fire.
Yeah, part of that that paradigm comes from the early fire ecologists who studied ponderosa pine forests primarily. And ponderosa pine forests, particularly in the Southwest, appeared to have this typical fire regime of low severity, high frequency. In other words, a fire every 5 to 10 years would burn through the forest, mostly burning up grass and dried needles on the forest floor, but without killing the larger trees. And as a result of that kind of fire, you had a forest that was dominated by large ponderosa pine and not very many young ponderosa pine, because most of them would get killed by these periodic fires. That model, sometimes called the Southwest pine model, was then sort of exported throughout the West, and many people adopted it and thought it applied to all the forests around the West. The problem with it is that almost every other plant community in the West doesn't burn that way. Everything from chaparral and sagebrush ecosystems to subalpine fir and lodgepole pine, and I don't know how many of your listeners know all these species, but they tend to be found at higher elevation in the mountains of the West. Those species tend to burn less frequently, or there's less frequent fires in those kinds of plant communities, and the interval between fires is much longer. And as a result, they naturally accumulate fuels over a period of time. And the reason they don't burn frequently is it takes some very specific kinds of conditions to burn a high elevation forest, which tend to be, because they're high elevation, they tend to be wetter and moister than most other forests. And the conditions are very low humidity, usually under 5% humidity, very high temperatures, you know, in the 90s, 100 degrees, and probably the most critical factor is wind. And wind does not affect fire linearly. It's exponential. And we know this from our campfire experiences. You know, you blow on a campfire that's just smoldering, and you keep blowing on it, and eventually, you know, it'll flare up into flames. And that is exactly how it works in a larger forest ecosystem. So we have, throughout, if you look at what dominates most plant communities of the West, it isn't ponderosa pine. It's all these other tree species that, to one degree or another, tend to burn at higher severity less frequently. And, you know, depending on the species, that frequency will vary somewhat. But almost all of them tend to burn at longer periods of time or longer intervals than we have ever been trying to put out fires. So to argue that fire suppression is causing, as was done, for example, in Yellowstone Park in 1988, some people who didn't understand the fire regime of Yellowstone said, well, fire suppression allowed those big fires to occur. Well, no, it didn't, because in lodgepole pine forests, which dominate Yellowstone, fires tend to occur at anywhere from 100 to 400-year intervals. And we have not been successful. We haven't even been around putting out fires for 400 years. So, you know, we didn't have fuel buildup that was abnormal. What we had in Yellowstone in 88 was some of the lowest humidity, 1 to 2% humidity, combined with winds sometimes of 50 and 60 miles per hour, and an extensive drought. And that's what created the large fires. And what you find is that when we have those conditions, we really can't stop the fires. We had 10,000 firefighters trying to stop the Yellowstone fires. What stopped them was snowfall on September 10th or 11th, somewhere around in there, early September. It snowed, and that's what extinguished the fires. All the other efforts, and it was massive, had no effect. And that's one of the lessons to be learned which is many under those kinds of conditions, we cannot control and put out fires. And the interesting thing is that the vast majority of acreage burned annually across the West is only a few very large fires. So it's the large fires that we can't control that are doing most of the ecological work. And the other irony about that is agencies like the Forest Service are spending billions of dollars thinning forests and doing other measures to try to reduce the flammability of forests, believing that they will reduce these large fires. But when those conditions are, I call it ripe for a major burn, those fires burn across everything. They burn through fuel reductions. They cross 16 lane, zero fuel highways. They are able to go around clear cuts. Fuel reductions don't stop them. And so they are the fires that present the most threat to communities because we can't stop them. At the same time, they are the fires that all this logging that we're doing really won't affect. So it really makes for a, sort of an insane forest policy.
So you mentioned Yellowstone. It isn't you can't see my face. You can't know that I'm smiling as I say this, but isn't Yellowstone just a great example of how destructive these fires are and how it completely destroyed the entire biome of Yellowstone?
Well, of course, I know you're being cynical there, but yeah, Yellowstone's a great example of how fires rejuvenate the forest. And one of the ironies
in
Yellowstone...
I've never forgotten that. It made me so angry. The book by Greg Easterbrook, who's actually a sports writer, I don't know what he has to do with nature. Anyway, about how it was so terrible that they let the fire burn, and it cracked me up because he was completely wrong on every account.
Well, not only that, there's some interesting other information about Yellowstone fires. We've learned so much from them. But for example, some of the greatest rejuvenation greatest density of seedlings were in the parts that burned the hottest. The most severe burns had the greatest rejuvenation, despite people saying, oh, we're going to have sterilized soils. Another lesson learned from Yellowstone is prior to the 88 fires, and this sort of gets back to another point I was trying to make earlier, from 1972 to 1988, they had a policy of not putting out any fires in the backcountry. And what happened was most of the fires did not burn more than a few acres, number one. They had a few larger ones of 1,000 acres and a few others a little bit larger than that, but basically did not burn very much out of the whole ecosystem. And they all self-extinguished. In other words, they went on their own without us doing anything. And what happens is we would normally put firefighters on all these fires, and then we claim that we put them out when, in fact, they were going to go out anyway. And it's sort of the reason it's important is because there's this assumption that we've been putting out fires for maybe 50 years since World War II, but a lot of the fires we've been putting out were destined to go out anyway without burning much acreage. So you could argue that fire suppression may have had a negligible effect on most ecosystems because at least in a lot of them, the fires self-extinguished on their own. And by contrast, when the conditions are good for a burn, we cannot put them out. And so this idea that fuel buildup led to the 88 fires, you can say, well, why didn't Yellowstone burn in 1987 or 86? There was as much fuel then. This is because the conditions for a fire didn't exist. And even though there were lightning strikes and fires started in those years, they basically just went out.
So you mentioned that some of these places will have fires every 1 to 400 years. And what is the – one of the questions that I've been wondering ever since you started talking about this is, in one of these hot fires, what is the tree mortality? Because some of these trees – the elders of these trees can be 600-700 years old. So did they survive a fire, or did they simply get lucky to not have a fire in their lifetime? Are there these catastrophic fires, did they kill 100% of the trees, or do they kill 60%, 40%? What would be sorry, I used the word catastrophic. That shows how deep the propaganda is. One of these
yeah.
one of these large fires, we could say cataclysm, that's a value-neutral word, one of these huge regenerative hot fires, what mortality will there be on the big trees?
Well, that's a very good question. I'm glad you asked it. Most wildfires burn in a mosaic, and there will be patches that are lightly burned, some that are not burned, and then some that are burned severely. So it would depend upon where they were in that matrix. What is coming out from some of the research, and it's pretty interesting, is that all the fires that are considered to be large, quote, catastrophic fires, tend to have the majority of their acreage to be burned at low to very mixed in severity fires, even though people think of them as, you know, completely killing all the trees across the landscape. So, for example, a statistic that I have sort of memorized here is in 2012 in Idaho, there was 1.75 million acres of land burned in wildfires, but only 13% of that 1.75 million acres was burned at high severity. And the rest was either mixed to, and the majority was low severity. I believe it was like 60-some percent was low severity to non-burn within the perimeter of the entire fire. So what happens is, yes, some big trees will be killed, but since fires like this don't happen very often, you know, you might, the next fire that comes along might be 200 years from now or 300 years from now or longer, then the trees that have escaped the burn this time are the ones that become the old growth that and the very large trees that are around it when the next fire comes through. And if it gets through and they happen to be part of the matrix that doesn't burn again, then they're the ones that might be 1,000 years old. And it should be said that a lot of these older trees have adaptations that give them resistance to fire as well. Thick bark, self-pruning where the lower branches die back so that there's not a ladder to take flames up into the top of the trees. Or a lot of them are just growing on sites that for whatever reason don't burn very well. Rocky ridges, real wet bottomlands and places like that. So if you put it all together, we don't in the long run, you know, we wouldn't have old growth forests if it was the kind of thing where they all burned up all the time. And the fact is they don't burn up all the time. And that's why we've had old growth forests in the past. And if we don't log it all, we'll have old growth forests growing in numbers and in, you know, scale in the future.
So there's just one thing I want to mention before we move on, which is that when we're talking about fire dependent, what is it, lodgepole pine? Which is the pine tree that requires forests to pop open the pine cones?
Well, actually, it's lodgepole is one, and not it. That's a generalization. There are some lodgepole in every population that will shed seeds even without a fire. But in like Yellowstone, for example, a lot of the lodgepole pine there, their cones only open when they've been heated. And that's one of the reasons why they get the jump on other tree species after a fire, because they're the first ones to recolonize it with seeds. But there are a whole lot of other pine species in particular. In California, for example, knobcone pine, some of the other bishop pine, the Monterey pine, a lot of those trees also do well after a fire because their cones will open and shed more seeds.
So I just want to be clear. This, are you saying, like there was the huge fire in Michigan and also a huge fire in Idaho in the late 19th century or early 20th century, I don't remember which, that were on logged over lands, and are you saying that that humans through logging can't create conditions for even larger fires? Are you saying that it's that basically fires are essentially out of our control completely?
Yes and no. There are two different things. The fire that happened in Michigan in that area I'm not that familiar with, but my understanding was logging slash that contributed greatly to those large fires.
That's absolutely true.
Yeah. And then the other one I think you're referring to is the 1910 burn, which burned across northern Idaho and western Montana. And much of that land had not been logged much. And in fact, it's a good example of, I use it all the time to show how the idea that fire suppression leads to big fires. The 1910 fire happened. It burned over 3 million, some say 3.5 million acres, way bigger than any fire we've had today. And yet that was long before there was any kind of effective fire suppression in existence. And it burned that way because it had those conditions that I mentioned earlier. It was particularly droughty. It was very, very low humidity, and they had particularly high winds for a number of days that fanned the flames. And what you get is burning embers that are blown sometimes as much as 2 or 3 miles ahead of a fire front, and they set new fires. And that's one of the reasons why it's impossible to stop large fires. All these fires that have burned up communities around the West, a lot of them were wind-driven fires where the fire itself, you know, the main burning area never reached the houses. What reached the houses was burning embers that were blown a mile or two ahead of the fire front and landed on somebody's back porch with firewood stacks there or on top of a cedar-shake roof with pine needles on it. And those then set those houses on fire. And then and when you go to those places, it's pretty striking. I've been to a whole lot of those communities that have had fires, South Lake Tahoe, Los Alamos, Waldo Canyon in Colorado, et cetera. And the striking thing is you will see live green pine trees and other trees surrounding the burnt out foundations, which indicates that the fire did not burn through to the house, because otherwise it would have burned up those green trees. It is, in fact, that burning embers on top of the houses caused them to burn to the ground. And that gets back to another important point that I want to mention before I forget, and that is the best way to protect communities. Well, there's two ways. One is to zone so you don't build in fire-prone ecosystems in the first place, and that's very important. And we should be looking at fires in the same way we look at floods on rivers. At least in a lot of parts of the country anymore, they have zoning and say you can't build your house in the floodplain, because we know sooner or later there's going to be a flood. And we have to have the same attitude about fire. Sooner or later, there's going to be a fire. So putting a house in a fire-prone ecosystem just sets up a conflict where we'll spend a lot of money trying to protect that house, firefighters' lives will be at risk, and so forth. And the second thing is for houses that already are inappropriately built in inappropriate areas, you can do much to reduce the flammability of those homes. A metal roof, for example, will allow 90 to 95% of the homes to live through or survive, however you want to use the term, a very high severity fire. And the reason is that these high severity fires, they're windblown. The wind is blowing the fire, and the fire is only in any one place for 5 to 10 minutes. And it has intense heat, but if things don't ignite in that 5 to 10 minutes, it's already moved on to the next source of material to burn. And the wall of a typical house, for example, you have to have heat against it for 20 minutes to a half an hour to make it ignite. So if there's nothing that's small, flammable against that house wall that doesn't catch on fire and provide that source of heat, then the fire will usually go beyond and the house will survive. So it's very key to how we can live with wildfire is reducing the flammability of homes. The thing is, that's almost all on private land around the West, and it's the responsibility, or should be the responsibility, of the homeowner. And yet people think we can fireproof the forest by logging it. And in truth, that doesn't work. In fact, if you look around the West at major wildfires, a good percentage of them burn through heavily logged areas that are already logged. And that logging did not change the outcome of those fires. And so there's just plenty of anecdotal evidence to that effect. And what we do have also anecdotally is that homes that have reduced the flammability in that ignition zone, and we're talking only about 100 to 200 feet, if you do that, you have a good chance that that home will survive. And that ought to be where we're putting our emphasis on, not trying to log the forest across the West, because we'll never, never have a significant impact on that. Can I just jump ahead and say one more thing about that?
Please, please.
Another important thing is, you know, the evidence that fuel reductions, or, and I'm particularly talking about logging and thinning as opposed to prescribed burning, those logging things have been shown often to actually increase fire susceptibility, because they put a lot of the fine fuels like pine needles and cones and so forth on the ground. The other thing that happens is you open up the forest to greater drying and wind penetration. And since the two things that really carry a high severity fire are wind and the you know, drying of the fuels because of low humidity and so forth, the thinning can often exacerbate those conditions and make it more flammable. And the other part of it that gets forgotten, even if you do your fuel reductions properly, which is seldom the case because a lot of them are just disguised logging sales, but if you were to do it properly, in some places you might actually change the behavior of a fire. But the problem is, as soon as you open up the forest by thinning, you promote more growth of small trees and vegetation like grass and other flammable materials. So unless you retreat that fuel reduction site periodically, usually every 5 to 10 years, its effectiveness declines to the point where it's actually more burnable than it was if you hadn't touched it at all. And the problem I see with the Forest Service policy is that, you know, they're doing these logging sales and thinning enterprises, and they never have time to go back and retreat them usually. And so they're just making, in many cases, conditions worse, not to mention that logging is not benign. You bring in weeds, you remove biomass, you disturb sensitive wildlife, you're probably going to do it having roads, and roads are, you know, sources of erosion for streams and affect fisheries. So you really have to say, you know, what would be a smart policy? Well, a smart policy, in my view, would be to work on reducing the flammability of homes in the home ignition sites zone so that we don't build new homes there. And if we're going to do fuel reductions, they should be located immediately adjacent to communities and be funded so that the proper maintenance can be continue into the future. And logging 20 miles away from a town or 30 miles away from a town is just a waste of time in terms of trying to reduce the fire risk to those towns.
So we hear, I mean, you've alluded to this a couple times, but we hear a lot the solution, in quotes, to the, quote, problem, end quote, of wildfires is logging, and that they can call it fuels reduction, they can call it whatever they want, but it amounts to logging. And oftentimes it is the Forest Service and the timber industry will promote actually logging of merchantable timber as opposed to taking out, you know, tiny dog hair. And of course that's because they're worth money. So is it conceivable to you that the Forest Service and timber industry could, I don't know, is it even conceivable that they could use fire, and politicians could use fire as an excuse just to log? Is that even conceivable to you?
That's exactly what I think is going on in most cases.
I'm completely kidding.
Yeah. And reality is that because there's such a fear among people that their homes will burn down, and we have such a fear of wildfire in general and the perception that it's damaging the forest, it's easy to sell the idea that we need to do something. to reduce the occurrence of such fires. And I think the public has gotten to the point where the message that fire isn't all bad is pretty well established, but part of that message is what we described earlier. It's only the low severity, high frequency fires that people think are okay. And what needs to be understood is that these high severity, larger fires are actually what does most of the ecological work, that they're not abnormal. They're not the result of fuel buildup due to fire suppression, that they are the natural way that these ecosystems tend to rejuvenate themselves. And then the other part, as I said, is we have to understand that we can't really control these kinds of fires. An analogy I might give is sort of like building levees in New Orleans for hurricanes, and they worked for many years and kept out water out of the city until a Category 5 hurricane, Katrina, hit directly on New Orleans. In a sense, these larger fires are just like a Category 5 hurricane. They're not very common, but when they hit the place where you're at, whatever you've got up there to sort of protect your homes, whether it's levees on the river or fuel reductions, they just don't work against that kind of force of nature. And we have to realize that against those kinds of forces of nature, we are unable to control the situation, which I think is a great thing myself. But it also is that in trying to do that, we put people's lives at risk, and we spend lots and lots of money that could be spent better on other projects that would be more successful. Like, for example, perhaps providing funds to people who do live in these vulnerable places to reduce the flammability of their homes and surroundings would be a better expenditure of public funds than subsidizing logging sales for timber companies. And by the way, almost all federal logging sales lose money. So we're losing money. We're not having the achieving the goals that we presumably say are our target, that is to keep large fires from happening. And we introduce all sorts of other negatives like weeds into the ecosystem or disturbance to sensitive animals. And so if you consider all those external costs as well as the actual costs of the money losing timber sales, it's really a kind of an insane policy. But I think you have to realize, and you probably do, but maybe the listeners don't, that the Forest Service started out back in the 1900s based on the whole idea that it was going to stop fires. That's how it got its original start after the 1910 burn that I mentioned earlier. And so they are these large firefighting efforts was the original purpose for the Forest Service in existence. And then through the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, particularly and into the 90s, logging became more and more important mission of the Forest Service. And then in the 1990s, due to things like the spotted owl and other things, logging was greatly reduced on national forest lands because they'd already exceeded so many limits. And that resulted in a crisis to the Forest Service. They no longer had a reason for their existence. And what they've adopted to provide a justification for the bureaucracy is now firefighting again, so that 50 to 60% of its budget now is spent on fighting fires. And without fires, or you know, the dragon to slay, there would be less reason for the bureaucracy to exist as traditionally understood. And therefore, you know, they use fire to fund the bureaucracy. Now, I think there's lots that the Forest Service could be doing that could keep them equally employed, and it would be great for ecosystems and so forth. But it's harder to get Congress to fund things like, you know, saving endangered species as opposed to, you know, going out to supposedly, you know, slow down or control this threat known as wildfire.
So a couple of things. One of them is that I live in Redwood Forest here in far northern California, And the local Forest Service is actually pretty good. And the reason the local Forest Service is actually pretty good is A, yes, part of it is fire dependent, but the lower parts are not. But the real reason is because they don't have a timber sale program. And so they actually spend their money on some decent things like, getting rid of old roads. It's actually pretty extraordinary after having lived in Idaho, Washington, Colorado, where the Forest Service is really the enemy, to actually have a decent National Forest Administration around here. Very interesting. Anyway, leave that aside. So a couple questions I have. One of them is, so if we exclude the effects of global warming on fires for a moment, what are the data? I think you may have said this, but I want to be really clear. What are the data on the frequency and severity of fires over the past 100 years or so around the West? Have fires been increasing because of fire suppression? Or is the data actually shows the number and severity of fires has remained fairly constant? What does it show?
Well, this is one of those tricks of statistics. It all depends upon what you use as your starting point. And that's because in the last century, from 1900 to 2000, there was a period between about the end of the 1930s all the way till the late 1980s, like when Yellowstone burned, when the climate was moister and cooler throughout most of the West, due to offshore currents that brought that kind of climate to dominate for a while. And that's exactly the period when agencies claim to have been successful at fire suppression. Really, fire suppression didn't really get off the ground until after World War II, when they had helicopters and air tankers and smoke jumpers and all that kind of thing. And but that was exactly the time when things were moister and cooler. If you go back closer to 1900, you have like the 1910 burn that I mentioned earlier, that burned 3 to 3.5 million acres of land, and there were lots of other big fires then. And then after 88, we've gone into another, due to a shift offshore, we've gone into another warmer, drier period around a lot of the West with drought and so forth. Even if you put aside climate change, which may be driving it further, but we've always had these kinds of oscillations between moister, cooler conditions and drier, hotter conditions. And what you find is, if you go back to 1900 and you use that as your starting point, we are not really experiencing any more larger or more extensive fires than existed in the past. If your starting point is like 1950, then yes, it has that appearance, because for a lot of that period between 1950 and the late 1980s was a moister cooler period. And moist cool does two things. And one, it limits ignitions to begin with, and then even if something ignites, it won't spread very well. So you get small fires, you get less fires, and you smaller fires that don't turn into large fires. And the other thing you get with moister cooler conditions is you get better seedling establishment and growth, which would lead to denser forests, which is attributed to fire suppression, but it may be just because it was wetter and cooler than anything. So basically, the answer is, all depends on when you're starting and using as your point of reference, as with a lot of these questions.
Okay, this is great. This is so helpful. I think it's going to be so educational to a lot of people, myself included. We have about 5 minutes left, but I want to ask a semi-off-topic question, because you are one of the few people I would trust to be able to that I could ask this question and get an answer, a straight answer, which is, what about all the stuff we hear all the time about massive beetle kill, and those now become tinder boxes? Across much of the West, we've heard A, stories about massive beetle kill, and B, that's a reason to log. And can you answer that in terms of, specifically in terms of fire?
Yes. The short answer is, beetle kill does not increase the occurrence of fires. In fact, it has a tendency in a lot of cases to reduce the occurrence of fire. And the reason is, it gets back to the point I said earlier, fires are carried by fine fuels like pine needles, cones, grass and so forth. And what you have when you have beetle kill is after, you know, a couple of years, the needles fall off and the smaller branches get knocked off in winter storms. And the snags that are left are really don't burn very well. We know this from our experience with campfires. You put a big log on the campfire, unless you have a lot of coals underneath it, that won't burn very well. We've always put small twigs and so forth to get a fire going and keep it going. So it's the same thing in a forest. And under the severe fire conditions of drought and low humidity, green trees actually burn better because they have all these fine fuels intact, the needles and so forth, on the tree. And those needles have resins in them, many of which are flammable. So that if you've ever watched some of these green trees go up in flames, I mean, they literally explode at times like they've got gasoline in them. And that is why thinning to, you know, to log the forests that have been killed by beetles, actually what it does is it has no effect on the fires, and it can actually increase the likelihood of a future fire because it will hasten the regrowth of smaller trees underneath that will become ladder fuels and eventually the new forest that will be susceptible to fires.
Do you think in the future, we shouldn't say this in public, but I will anyway. Do you think in the future we could do a whole show on just beetles? Is there enough interesting things to say about it, the beetles and
forests? Yeah. The beetle things is pretty darn interesting, the relationship with beetles. Beetles are... you know, some people are calling beetles a keystone species because the forests that result after beetle kill have an incredible amount of biodiversity, which severely burned forests also do, by the way. Severely burned forests have the second greatest biodiversity found after old-growth forests. So it's kind of counterintuitive, but both of these things, beetles and fire, are very important to sustaining our forest ecosystems.
So we have like 2 minutes left, and I'm thinking one of the things that I got out of today that's really helpful is when I hear a figure like 200,000 acres are burned, what that actually probably means is about out of 200,000 acres, maybe 10,000 were burned pretty hard, and the rest of it was a mosaic, some of which wasn't burned at all, and some of which was burned lightly, some of it was burned more. So that's one thing I got from this. And the other thing I got from this is that fires are like a flood, a form of rejuvenation. Are there other points you want people to get from this particular interview?
Yeah, and I'm going to repeat myself, but sometimes repeating helps people remember. And that is that you will not get fires to burn if the conditions for a burn don't exist. So if you don't have drought, low humidity, and high winds, you're not going to get fire. It doesn't matter if you have a lot of fuel. The Coast Range of Oregon and Washington has more biomass per acre, more fuel sitting there in the forest floor than any place else in the U.S., and it hardly ever burns because it's usually too moist. So it really is important to understand that unless you have the right, what drives most large fires is not fuels. It is the weather, climate conditions. And that is why fuel reductions just basically are not the answer, because they're not addressing what is the real cause of large fires. And as I said earlier, even if we could control the large fires, I would not be an advocate of that. I think the way we need to treat fires is sort of the way that at least I treat mosquitoes, which is I put on mosquito repellent to keep them from biting my arms. I have a screen on my net. I have screened windows in my house, but I don't go out into the landscape around me and try to get rid of all the mosquitoes, because mosquitoes are important for all sorts of things. So we need to be treating fires the same way. We should make our homes and our communities safe by reducing the flammability around the homes and allow fires to the degree that we can to burn basically unmolested, monitored. It would be a lot cheaper to monitor most of these fires, which will self-extinguish in most cases when the conditions for driving that fire no longer exist, without us having to do anything. And maybe at the, you know, when the weather changes, like Yellowstone in 88, when the snow came, you know, there was a mop-up crews out there getting the last burning snags, extinguished. That's when you might want to jump on a fire. But doing much before that is just a waste of time.
So So I think you've already answered this, but so if they made you the king of all things fire in this country, it's pretty clear you would not do the fuel suppression, you would not removal. I mean, you would not do the fuel removal, so-called. I hate that term. You would not. It sounds like you. Is there anything else you would do that you haven't already said? Are there any things you want to say about fire? I haven't given you the opportunity.
Well, I would clarify and say I wouldn't do most fuel reductions. Immediately adjacent to communities, I would support that only in that it, you're only going to have support for wildfires beyond that when people feel safe. And if you were to do them frequently, in other words, kept fuels from building up and also reduced the flammability of the homes, the two and together could provide a degree of safety so people will feel at home. But beyond that sort of urban fringe, no, I don't think we need fuel reductions. I think fires and beetles are the way to thin our forests and to recycle nutrients, and they do a much better job than anything we can do. And what we need to do is learn that these processes are different. Logging is not the same as a fire. And if for no other reason than that you remove the biomass, which is important. And so we have to understand that there are all sorts of things going on with fire that don't happen with logging. Another example is smoke will kill some forest pathogens. The charred charcoal that remains helps to store carbon for a long period of time. There's all sorts of things happen in a fire that don't happen when you log. So that's why we need fires, and we need to have a healthy respect for them and realize that they are as critical to forest ecosystem. A healthy forest ecosystem is one that has fires periodically and occasionally burning through them, sometimes with severe consequences for the individual trees.
Well, thank you so much for all that. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been George Werther. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.